From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the English department of Clemson University when various members of the faculty were discussing the increasing number of requests from students to redo a paper or a test or a project. Some of the students didn't like their grades and they wanted opportunities to improve them. The director of undergraduate studies, Jonathan Beecher Field, wrote to his colleagues urging them to stand by the grades they give. He wrote, quote, "As the semester winds down, it's as good a time as any to remind you that the department supports you and your grading decisions. Grading writing is inherently subjective. Subjective is not the same thing as unfair. You teach in the Clemson English department because we trust your judgment. Assigning a grade is the end of teaching a class, not the beginning of a negotiation. As these conversations go back and forth, they become less productive and more volatile." End quote. And so Field ended with a template email that the faculty could use if students request a chance for a redo on any level. And the email reads, quote, "Dear student, I am sorry to hear that you are not happy with the grade you earned in class. In calculating grades, I followed the criteria outlined on the syllabus and assigned grades according to those criteria. If you wish to pursue the matter further, you are free to contact Professor Field, the Director of Undergraduate Studies. Sincerely, your instructor." End quote. Last month on Connections, we heard from admissions directors of local universities who said that high school transcripts are becoming harder to distinguish from one another because grades are higher across the board. All of this inspired us to ask, when do students deserve a do-over? When should high school or college students be permitted to retest or resubmit a paper? What is the best way to measure their achievement or whether they have learned? Our guests this hour have a lot of thoughts on that. Don't you, Leah Stacey, professor of English and Communication at Nazareth College and an adjunct professor at the Newhouse School of Communication at Syracuse University. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And you do have some thoughts, don't you?
I do have thoughts.
Yeah. Joe Cope is here, a history professor and interim associate provost for student success at SUNY Geneseo. Professor Cope, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And also here is Larry Fry, the head of school at the Harley School. Larry, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
All right, let's go around the table. I'll start with you, Larry. Do you hear of students asking for redos with any frequency or any increasing frequency these days?
Well, so at the Harley School, this is mainly something that would happen at the high school level. The school is actually nursery through 12, of course. And the arc of learning and how you assess learning from a 3-year-old to an 18-year-old is actually a topic of great interest, and I wonder if we'll have a minute to get into it later. But we do see, you know, increasing pressure on our students, both self-imposed and kind of imposed from the outside in. As a faculty, we're doing everything we can to mitigate that pressure, the pressure that they feel. But at the same time, they have this notion that if they don't get in to Geneseo or they don't get into whatever college they think is, you know, kind of the ticket for them, then they failed. A few years ago, Frank Bruni from the New York Times published a book. I think the title was "Where You Go Is Not Who You Are," or "Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be." And that's a crucial lesson that we try to impart to our kids. But of course, they've internalized 10 million signals friends, family, society that they need to ace everything. They need to get into the best college in the world. And that's the ticket to a beautiful life.
So if I can distill it, it sounds like maybe there is more of an interest in getting a rechance or redo, but that's coming from outside pressure that the students are feeling in various ways.
Yeah, I think they feel that. And, you know, we don't have a policy of the type they have at Clemson or anything like that. You know, our approach is to try to be really clear and transparent about what we're trying to accomplish in the course and what we're asking of the kids. I think if you do that and you check to see that they understand that part of what you're doing, not that you would test them on that, but, you know, that would be a way of, you know, kind of building a more collegial way of doing all this. Nonetheless, kids will occasionally come forward and say, "You got to be kidding me. What do you mean a B on this amazing paper that I submitted to you?" Teachers should be able to respond to that. They should know what the kind of logic is of their grade and also the logic of what they've been asking the kids to do. But nonetheless, it's something that plagues, I think, every school in America.
Okay. Professor Stacey.
Yeah, I echo a lot of those thoughts on the college level. I also identify with the Clemson, problem of having these subjective projects. I teach in communications and media, and so many of our projects are very subjective, but I always explain, you know, I'm looking at this as, is it something that could be professional work eventually right now? And there's a rubric that we go through that, you know, we run every project through. But there are still the emails and the requests for more time, or I guess redos aren't really a problem because I have a series of drafts for almost every project. And sometimes the drafts are optional. And that's where sometimes they skip the draft because they have that opportunity. You know, I say, if you need to take the time and work on something else, do that. If you're not, you know, particularly worried about this, prioritize what you need to do. And then they'll turn in just that final draft and they'll say, well, can I redo this? And I'm like, no, you missed the draft. Like it's done. We're done here.
And you're firm with that.
Yeah, I am. Unless there's, I mean, every once in a while, a student has a very serious family issue. And especially if they can provide proof of that issue.
Which feels cold, but having taught one class in my life.
Yeah.
One time at NAS. Mm-hmm. But this is true everywhere. So this is not, it's remarkable how many family illnesses do come up.
Well.
And I don't say, that sounds flippant, but I'm just saying.
No, there have been times.
There's
when
sort of a trust but verify here.
Yeah, there's only so many times your grandmother can die in one semester. And that is a story that I'm sure we all share. But you know the students after, and especially at a school like NAS, I know my students. Right. I'm very close with my students. Our program is only about 60 students. And so I have the opportunity to really work with them, really get to know them. And so if a student who is a hard worker and, you know, always in class, always showing up, going above and beyond, comes to me and says, I have this family issue that's going on. I need an extra week. If I can give them that extra week, I'm going to. Because I want them to feel good about the work that they've turned in. And if that extra week is not going to, you know, really damage the class or other students, why wouldn't I give them that opportunity?
Okay. Professor Cope.
Sure. Going back to the Clemson example, yeah. I think, you know, one of the things that you see in that email is we're talking about grades after they've been recorded. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, in a perfect world, what we would want to do is have that conversation with the student before the semester ends and really think about ways to structure assignments, structure courses, so that students are working, as Leah said, progressively over the course of the semester, maybe in small chunks, getting lots of feedback, so that they're really clear on where they stand in their progress through a class. In my sense, when we see students who are unhappy about grades, it's often a matter of communications and transparency. Mm-hmm. Either the faculty hasn't communicated, you know, expectations clearly in the syllabus or hasn't shown, you know, this is what I expect out of this class, or the faculty has communicated those expectations, but the student hasn't really grappled with what those mean in terms of their work. There are things that you can do to correct for that, using rubrics, for example, that spell out very clearly, this is how your grade is going to be assigned. These are the things that I'm looking for in the assignment, scaffolded assignments so that students, again, are working progressively over the course of the semester on work. Again, really opening or creating opportunities to open conversations with students throughout the semester about their grades, about their progress, and more importantly, to try to shift that conversation in some ways away from grades and back to learning, which is really yeah. what we're trying to focus on.
Yeah, and so let's hit the subtext before we even go on here, because I want to ask our guests how they even define what grade inflation is or if they think there's a harm there. But the subtext here, let's be clear, is that, well, students these days are softer, that they complain more, that they want better grades even if they don't do the work. And I can tell you, I had a moment where I complained when I was in high school about a paper that got an F because it wasn't stapled, and it was listed that it had to be stapled and submitted, and I didn't staple it, and I was given an F. And I thought, this, Ms. Weatherby, if you're listening, you know what? I think you were right, and I was wrong. But listen, I was very angry. I put a lot of work into this, and I did not read the instructions on how to submit it. Well, she taught me a lesson there, and it worked out. But I pounded the table. So students, it's not new that students would ask for a chance to redo a paper or retest or even get the grade raised. But the question is whether it's happening more often and if that's indicative of something about modern society. Professor, what do you think?
Well, to go back to your point, I think, you know, it is important to mark out the notion of faculty complaining about students is something that goes back almost to the beginning of the university yes. system. There was a viral blog post on medieval.net back in 2015 that was citing historical documents from the 14th century at the University of Bologna, where faculty are complaining about students being lazy and trying to game the system. And right. so, you know, I think your point that this is kind of a pastime in higher education is well taken. You know, in terms of thinking about defining what do we mean by grade inflation, I do think it's important to differentiate between the sort of egregious inflation of the grades just for the sake of making students happy and changes in higher education pedagogy that have maybe made it more possible for students to succeed in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And again, so when I was an undergraduate in the early 1990s, in my history classes, the standard assessment mechanism was two or three in-class blue book exams and a paper. Timed exams, very little feedback when those were graded. You are given instructions on what the final paper should look like, and you hand it in, and there are no preliminary assignments. In a lot of ways, that's really setting a student up to fail. They don't know at the beginning of the project, well, this is not a great path to be on. They don't have an opportunity to course correct or seek help. I think if you look at what is going on in my own department at Geneseo right now, history faculty have replaced Blue Book exams with more reflective take-home writing assignments. They're giving a lot more feedback. When we talk about research projects, we're talking about scaffolded assignments where students are handing something in every two or three weeks and getting feedback and getting information on how they can improve and be as successful as possible. If that student comes out of that class with a slightly higher grade, that's not really grade inflation. It's a reflection of the fact that they've been really given the tools to succeed in the classroom. And so I think we want to be really careful in differentiating between just handing out A's indiscriminately and ways that higher education has really started to think seriously about pedagogy and the ways to support student success in the classroom.
Scaffolded meaning that you're adding to it over time.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And in that way, as opposed to one high stakes moment or one single paper, they're not only learning as they go, but maybe it takes some of that pressure that Larry was talking about and mitigates it a little bit?
That's exactly right. Okay. And I think also the other thing that it does is it really promotes the notion that the skills that you're learning in an individual class are transferable to other settings. If you throw a student into the deep end of the pool and say, write me a 20-page research project without any guidance, they may not be able to mark out, these are the places where I could do better, these are some things that I could do differently next time. Whereas if they are getting that regular feedback, those are skills that they're learning that then they can take with them into the next class.
Okay. Professor Stacey, do you think there is any difference in current gen? Because I think what Joe is saying about, you know, if you think Gen Z is bad, the pre-Renaissance generation was really soft. Yeah, so everything old is new again. But is there something different now that you see?
Well, there's digital. And that's a big part of the conversation in my classes. Almost everything we do is digitally based. And I was having this discussion in my Comm 101 class when they were working on their final research paper. And someone remarked that they couldn't believe that their parents had to get books out of the library and type everything up. And then they just started sort of chattering about it in this round table. And they were like, yeah, I mean, everything must have just taken so much longer. And one girl was like, yeah, I made it through a whole season of such and such on Netflix while I was working on this paper. And then there's always that part of me that's like, oh my gosh, maybe I'm not giving them enough work. But I think that the digital world has made it so that they can do more. To me, though, that also means that they have more opportunity to engage and succeed while they're in college. And some students will just inherently take advantage of that, and some students will not. And that doesn't, you know, mean that that one student is going to be more successful in life. It just means that's where they're at that moment. That's what they want to do. And frankly, when they're in college, like you can't make that. They're adults. Sometimes I jokingly call them my baby adults, but they are adults and you can't make them do anything. At the beginning of every class, I say you're paying to be here or someone's paying for you to be here. And mm-hmm. you should take that seriously. There's, in essence, if you break it down, an hourly rate that you pay to come to class, and you want to make the most of that. This is an investment in your future and really in your present.
I think that's a great thing to keep in mind. Larry, what do you make of whether there's a difference now?
I'm not actually convinced that there is a difference. On the one hand, as Joe was saying, it's ever thus. You know, when I started in education 30 years ago, people were complaining about, you know, the kids being soft and grades floating ever farther north. So that's always been the case. Meanwhile, it is demonstrably true that grades are higher than they used to be. Peel that back, though, and, you know, before we got on air, we were talking about the fact that at Stanford, the average GPA is 3.55. Well, it's literally twice as hard to get into Stanford today as it was a generation ago. Probably more than twice as hard to get into Stanford as it was a generation ago. The students I work with are really good. They work really hard. They really want to know. And there's a kind of mix of motivations. One of the problems with grading is that it's, as they say, extrinsic. You know, you're kind of working for the grade as opposed to working for something interior, intrinsic. I've always had a hard time really wrapping my head around the question of whether or not grade inflation is a problem when any reasonable observer would come in and see the work that our kids are doing and say, wow, that's really good.
But that doesn't sound like grade inflation. Mm-hmm. At least at the Harley School or various settings where if the work is really good. Yeah. In other words, when you see that Stanford, and by the way, Chris from Pittsford, I'm going to come to you on the phone in a second. And listeners, we're already getting emails. We'll take your emails and phone calls if you want to weigh in on grade inflation or redos and new opportunities for students, whether it's appropriate or not or when it might be appropriate. What I hear from you is that if the quality is really high, then of course the results are going to be pretty good across the board. So when we see that Stanford University has an average GPA of 3.55 across campus, that to you is not obvious evidence of grade inflation. In other words, these are really high quality students who got in there, and it should be no surprise that they're doing the work to get those grades.
Yeah, I'm sure it vexes the old timers on the faculty. There's no doubt in my mind about that. But it is nonetheless demonstrably the case that the kids are getting in at half to one-third the rate that they did a generation ago. They have done extraordinary things just to get their application read by that admissions committee. The same is true at all the schools. And so it just needs to be contextualized with you know, real data. Just because the average GPA is higher than it used to be, it doesn't inherently mean that there's grade inflation. It could be that the work is better.
Okay. And just in terms of a little bit more data to kind of flesh out whether we're seeing grade inflation, this is from various sources at the high school level, and this only goes from 1990 to 2010. So, my gosh, we're almost a decade behind there now. Mm. But from 1990, the average GPA for a high school student in this country, male students 2.59, female students 2.77. So males in 30 years went from a 2.59 to a 2.9 on average in high school. Females went 2.77 to a 3.1. So about a 0.32 increase for men and women, young men and women, boys and girls in high school in 30 years in this country. And at the college level, we do see now the average GPA at four-year colleges is above a so-called B average. It's now 3.1 on average, but certain majors higher and certain majors lower. So again, before we jump to the phones, we'll do that in a second. Let's just finish that off there. Yeah. Is that any evidence of a problem to you?
I think it is evidence of grade inflation nationwide. Okay. That's a gigantic sample size. It's literally everybody. Mm-hmm. So if literally everybody is going through schooling that's not drastically different than it was 20 years ago, and everybody's grades are higher, then that's obviously a strong argument that there's some kind of inflation that's happened there.
Is there damage? Is there harm when grades get inflated?
The harm, I think, ultimately is in the avoidance of the struggle. Because I think ultimately a really good education includes bumping up against something that's really hard for you. Every kid should do that.
Yes.
And it's good for them. And if you're getting an A-, that doesn't quite feel like it's a struggle to me.
Oh, okay. And Larry, let me follow up with this just because I want to square this, not because I think I'm calling out any hypocrisy on your part. But when you said earlier that at the Harley School, you want to mitigate a lot of those sources of pressure that the students feel, but now you're also saying they need to feel the struggle. Square that for me.
Oh, I do. I think that's absolutely important. The question of struggle, though, doesn't mean struggling with extrinsic, at some level, meaningless measures. You know, the question of the SAT, for example, is an extrinsic, for a lot of kids, meaningless measure of what their readiness is. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want my kids to struggle with that. I want them to do their best and move on. What I do want my kids to struggle with is stuff that's genuinely important to them, stuff that they're struggling with, you know, in terms of like the intellectual sort of level of the challenge, let's say, or defining something that they really care about and want to pursue. We have students doing capstone projects at the senior year level, and kids are figuring out like, well, I want to do a study on refugees in Rochester. That's a really complex question. And you can imagine any kid, certainly I would struggle with the question of like, well, how do I figure out how to do something meaningful on this? What would be a way of sharing what I've learned? What would be a way of measuring it? You know, those are the kinds of struggles that I want my kids to be dealing with. The trouble with grades and things like SATs is that they're extrinsic. The kids bang their heads against, you know, what ultimately will end up being one single number. And I think that hurts them.
Okay. Professor Stacey, when you see those grades across the country, high school and college level up in a generation as they are, is it a problem? Is there a possible harm there?
Yeah, I'm part of my brain still attributes that to digital and just the increase of resources, the increase of tools in the classroom. Again, that's really coming from my experience. But I like what you were saying because it's when I was at Newhouse, I remember when I was a student there myself, and I still love to get these emails from students after class, just the tears and the struggle of going through that learning process, sitting in an editing lab and getting something wrong over and over and over until you finally get it right. That to me is so much more important than a letter grade or percentage at the end of the semester. And I really try to drive that home with my students as well. You know, you want to come out learning these things. You don't just want to come out with a piece of paper that has a high GPA. Your future employer does not care. And that's the bottom line. Like, especially for the fields that my students want to go into, they need to know how to use the tools of their industry.
I think that is such an important point here because, and I think there's a big difference between high school and college grades mattering. In most college fields, in my experience, no one in the employment world cares what your GPA was in college. Mm-hmm. Though for admissions directors in colleges, they do care about GPAs and they care about scores. Yeah. So that's where the inflation may have
they
more
get,
of an
effect. Yeah, and they get stuck in that mindset, the students do. They are still very, especially until they get to about senior. I mean, of course, we joke about senioritis. But I think a lot of them by that point have figured out what is important. And for my students, as seniors, I'm about to teach senior seminar this semester. It is about portfolio work. It is not about grades. It is about coming, you know, having a chance to reflect on your last 4 years and create something that you really care about during this semester and then take that and go and apply to jobs.
Yeah, and that's really well said. Professor, Professor Cope, what do you think?
Sure, yeah, I think I'd reiterate that and say, you know, if you look at a transcript, you know, it's a list of classes and grades. It doesn't tell the story of a student's experience in education. The kinds of things that we've been talking about here in terms of project-based learning, in terms of portfolio development, those really do give a student the opportunity to make connections between their different educational experiences, talk about how they've applied skills from one experience to another experience, talk about how those skills are useful and meaningful in the world outside of the college. And so I think it's important for us, and there's a lot of this going on in higher ed right now, thinking about ways to empower students to be self-reflective, to take the time to do that kind of introspection and craft that narrative of their own experience. And part of that goes back to the point about failure, empowering students to see failure as something that really is a powerful educational experience. That when failure is bad is when the student gets that D paper and walks away from it and says, well, I'm just no good at this and I can never be good at this. The really powerful moment is when a student takes that paper or that project that they didn't do well on, looks it over, tries to understand how can I do better next time, and then incorporates that into the process of learning going forward.
All right, listeners, time for your phone calls and emails. We have a lot of them. So after our only break of the hour, we're coming right to your phone calls. You just heard Professor Joe Cope, a history professor and interim associate provost for student success at SUNY Geneseo. Leah Stacey is a professor of English and communication at NAS and an adjunct professor at the Newhouse School of Communication at Syracuse University. And Larry Fry is the head of school at the Harley School. We're talking grade inflation, how to define it, when it's appropriate to allow for extra work or redo of either a test, a project, a paper, etc., and what it tells us about students these days. Students these days. I hate that phrase. Let's get right back to your phone calls after our only break on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. Chris in Pittsford, first on the phone. Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your subject today reminds me of a brief joke by Albert Brooks, the comedian, in his first film. When he was referring to fine institutions of higher learning, he said, you know, if I'd studied harder and been graded more fairly, I too could have gone to an Ivy League institution. And I think that joke, to me at least, speaks to part of the problem. And, you know, all of us as students, myself included, were disappointed sometimes where we thought we had gotten the A minus or a B plus and we ended up with a C plus or a B minus. But I think it's quite insulting to educators, to institutions of higher learning, to high schools, to have kids too frequently asking for a break on a grade or a paper they wrote. And I blame parents for a lot of it. I know exact instances where parents were the ones who really motivated their children to go to the professor or teacher, or themselves went to the professor or teacher. And, you know, I think it's part of the problem with a lack of respect sometimes for authority and for educated people, kind of the war on intellectuals a little bit, maybe. But I support these professors and teachers you have on the air in saying that there should be very few instances where we allow a grade or a paper to be changed to a higher mark. And with that, I'll listen to any comments from your guests off the air. Thank you so much.
Chris, thank you. First of all, just based on Chris's phone call, let's ask the professors, how often does that happen? How often do you hear students who are maybe just complaining outright or just saying, this is unfair, I deserve a X and Y higher grade?
Sure. Well, when I was chair of the history department at Geneseo, you'd get one or two per semester. But in general, those would be resolved through communication. It often was a matter of getting the faculty member and the student together to talk through how was this grade calculated. And so, you know, I'm not seeing the kind of rampant students taking the barricades, demanding that grade or work be regraded or that grades be simply changed. Really, it's a matter of students trying to seek out information on how was this grade put together.
Do you hear from parents?
We do occasionally hear from parents, you know, FERPA rules also mean that conversations about education at the higher education level really should be between the student and the faculty member. Certainly, it's understandable that a parent who's paying tuition and is invested in the success of their student may also want to be part of that conversation. But in college, you're in an important transition, and it's really the point where we want students to take ownership of their academic experiences.
Okay. Leah?
I would echo that almost completely. It happens maybe a couple times a semester. I've been teaching at NAS for about 4 years, and I was adjuncting before that. A lot of semesters, it never happened at all. I think it really depends on the class and also the student. And I actually scrapped my attendance policy this semester as sort of an experiment. But what I did was I raised my participation, and I told them that if they got their phones out during class, it would zero out their participation. I think several people forgot about that during the semester. And so when I got those grade inquiries from two people, I simply wrote back, well, you shouldn't have taken your phone out during class. And then I never heard back from them.
But you were clear up front.
Yeah, well, and a lot of times they sit in the back of a class that's a little bit larger and they think I don't notice. And come on.
Students. Professor Stacy is making an important point. They can see you with the phone out.
Yes.
Put the phone away. Larry?
At the high school level, you know, that there are so many more sort of touch points and assessments that I think it's honestly common, you know, that you'll get at least a couple of either complaints or preferably help me understand this sort of inquiries from the kids over the course of time. The classes are small where I work, and we predicate the work on having a strong relationship between the adult and the kid. We want the kids to be able to come forward and look us in the eye and ask us questions, sometimes challenging questions. I think that's fine. And we have to be, you know, ready to respond. It's super rare that a grade gets changed, and thankfully, not often that parents call.
Okay. Back to your phone call. Scott in Prattsburg. Go ahead, Scott.
Thank you, Evan.
Sure.
First of all, the comment I got has nothing to do with the professors and teachers there. I've taken a lot of college classes along the way. I'm not a teacher, but one thing I can say, looking back at the teachers I have had, there are some that really stood out. and some that I really learned from. And, you know, I've been able to, of course, in my, you know, specialty is behavioral health, so working in groups in that setting, look, you know, I've learned from them, and I've actually modeled them to teach and do groups in the same manner. And that is a big plus. And when you get into tests, I want to tell you a real brief story about a professor I had at upstate New York. And he did something completely different out of the box. This was back in 1995. This was a summer class, microbiology, extremely intense. And we did it in, I don't know how many weeks, so it was brief. And what he did is when we had an exam, we could put whatever we wanted, anything, crammed on a 3x5 card. Anything we want. When we took the exam, pull it out, you can use it. Let me tell you something. And this is true. I was cleaning out my garage about, I don't know, 3 years ago. 3 years ago, and guess what I found? I found the card with everything you ever could possibly want to know. Wish that you'd almost need a magnifying glass to read on microbiome.
Yeah, I don't know how much that actually helps you if you have too much.
Well, I don't know, but I'll tell you what, if I had it in my pocket, when you looked, it was flashed back. Oh, I remember the Krebs cycle. I remember the loops of Henle. You know, and it was just right there. And, you know, long-term memory works different. But testing the short-term memory, how long do they remember? And, that's, you know, important. Sometimes the papers, too, if you get the opportunity to rewrite instead of, oh, sorry, that's it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you learn from that. And that's just my thought.
Yeah, Scott, thank you. That is a variation on the theme we've heard from some professors privately. And I have a small pile of comments that I wish I could read on the air from professors who have been submitting them in various forms saying, this is off the record. I'm saying, put it on the record. Mm-hmm. But in some degree, what I'm hearing, again, this is just a small sampling here, some professors saying, my job is to make sure that these students have learned something. And if that means occasionally allowing to rewrite a paper, allowing to take a test again, though I'm getting a little less of the taking a test, and I think it's because of what Scott is saying. If that is just rote memorization, that's sort of short-term.
Yeah.
And Larry, there's probably a lot of research. I asked you as the head of school, you probably know a lot about the research that tells you, does that rote memorization, does that lead to long-term learning, or are there better ways to do it?
There are better ways to do it.
Yeah. That was easy.
I mean, that's, you know, Plutarch said, the mind is not a vessel to be filled. It's not supposed to be, your head isn't like a bucket that you jam facts into and you screw the top onto. If you do it that way, there's always a hole in the bucket. The mind is not a vessel to be filled. It's a fire to be ignited. So that's the model that we try to follow at Harley. It's pretty hard to put a grade on how brightly burning a fire may be. It's actually sort of a harder challenge than a reductive, like, you know, test with multiple choice and that sort of thing. But I think it's the challenge we all have. And so, it sounds like these guys are doing it.
Well, can I ask all three of you then, when is it appropriate to do tests that are more rote memorization, mm-hmm. and when is it not? I mean, not that there's any perfect formula for this, but is it better for sort of maybe quizzes that keep students, you know, fresh with the nuts and bolts of what they might be learning to apply, but maybe not for bigger exams, or how do you view it?
Well, I think that there are just things in, you know, in the body of knowledge in any discipline that are hard to get at in another way. The periodic table is hard to get at without, you know, memorizing some of it. The times tables are hard to get at without that. So,
yeah, I mean, I still remember that lead is made of peanut butter because it's PB. I mean, and, you know, potassium is special because it's K. You know, I had to memorize. I came up with these weird rote memories. Yeah, I know. It's still in there. Next time you think of peanut butter, think of lead. So in some ways it can be effective.
Yeah, I think there are parts of most disciplines that require some of it. We depend on it too much. And we depend on it too much because of the structures of how we evaluate kids, that we are predicated on producing transcripts at the end of the whole thing. What are the transcripts reduced to? 3.16. You know, it reduces to that. And it's, you know, if you're going to build a transcript like that, then you're going to force yourself to grade in a certain way, and you're going to force yourself to build a school in a certain way. And it goes all the way back. And there's a real destructive quality to some of that.
Mm, okay. Professor Stacy, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I love all of that. I think the only time I usually use memorization is if I give them a news quiz and they have to, you know, read such and such articles from such and such newspaper, and then we go through. Even if they're learning AP style, I let them have a chunk that they can study beforehand, and then they can do open book. People still don't get 100 because sometimes they wait. They're like, it's open book. I'll find it when I'm taking the quiz. And, you know, there's like a certain student who does really well with that. There's another kind of student that needs to prepare a little bit more. So I feel like a lot of my classes, I really give them the reins, and however they want to sort of drive is up to them. And I'm always there to help them and to give feedback.
Okay. Professor Cope?
Yeah. I mean, I think going back to testing, I think it really varies widely depending on the discipline and the subject. And certainly in some areas, you just have to know the material, that it's content driven. But in others, and again, I come from my disciplinary background as a historian, I would much rather have a student leave my class with really solid skills in interpreting primary source evidence and thinking about ways to contextualize it and complicate it and understand how it fits into the bigger picture than be able to memorize all the dates of Civil War battles. And to go back to your caller,
sure,
too, you know, he mentioned the phenomenon of the really superstar professor that really engaged mm-hmm. with students. I think one of the things to note about higher education is that 20 or 30 years ago, there was very little professional development for pedagogy for faculty. When I went to graduate school, never took a single course in how to be a teacher. You were sort of thrown into the deep end of the pool, and you either thrive or you don't. I think one of the things we're seeing in higher ed now is a lot more attention paid to cultivating really excellent teaching skills amongst faculty, the creation of teaching and learning centers at most colleges and universities, structured professional development, so that rather than have this one superstar on campus that everybody knows their lectures are going to be the ones that you really want to sit in on, we're trying to ensure that all faculty are equipped with tools to be really excellent and engaging educators.
Yeah, and we all can remember the best educators and what we learn from them. And shout out to my twin brother, who is now teaching science of all things. My father can't believe that, but he's teaching science at not at the college level. But
he doesn't think that lead is made of peanut butter.
He doesn't think it's made of peanut butter. But that's a good memorization technique, Larry. And my brother is using the movie San Andreas with Dwayne The Rock Johnson. He's teaching seismology, and he says, I want a good explanation of all the scientific flaws in Dwayne The Rock Johnson's movie. And the student said, I can't believe we're watching The Rock in science class. So, but you know what? They're probably going to remember it. Let me get back to your phone calls. And this is Thomas in Webster. Go ahead, Thomas. Hi, Thomas. Are you there?
Yeah, hi, I'm Thomas. I actually go to the Harley School, so hi, Dr. Clark. Back to
hey,
the
Thomas.
Point about revising grades. Hi. Back to the point about like revising grades and stuff.
Yeah.
You said that was not an opportunity that you saw often at Harley. Well, I mean, I would disagree respectfully, but I mean, Mr. O'Brien, an English teacher, you give that essay up so often for papers, for books and stuff.
Right.
You hand it on time. He gives you the opportunity to revise it as much as you want, meet with him, figure out how to change it, and get an A on it, and he'll give you full points back.
Right, so I'm going to jump in, Thomas. This is a little too inside baseball, I think, for everybody in Rochester, but your point, nonetheless, is a really important one, which is that you're talking about a teacher who builds a course in such a way that kids get to iterate, as it were. You know, you write a draft, you get to do it again. If you feel like you've done something that isn't really the quality that you aspire to, he'll give you yet another shot. I think if you're clear about that up front, that's a completely great way to go. And he's a brilliant teacher, as both of us know. It's the cases where, you know, something is laid out, you get a grade, and then people just come in and complain and say, I want it to be higher. That's really rare.
Seth O'Brien, who we're talking about?
I think it's actually, we have many O'Briens.
Oh, you have lots of O'Briens. Seth is good, too.
Really good.
There must be another O'Brien that I don't know there.
Mm-hmm.
All the O'Briens are at the Harley School. Before I jump back to your phone calls, let me read an email from a listener who wants our panel's thoughts on this. He says, I recall having an English professor who, at least at the time, required students to produce, quote, A papers. This professor would grade according to the syllabus, include criticism and feedback, and if a paper fell short of an A, it was incumbent on the student to resubmit an improved paper as many times as it took until the paper merited an A grade. At first, I needed some convincing of this method, but I now support it. If the goal is demonstrating one's understanding or ability or mastery of a subject, how important really is the length or windingness of a student's path to achieving that goal.
Very good.
This professor ends up demanding a lot from students and predictably does give a lot of A's. What does the panel think about that method? Professor Cope.
Yeah, I think that gets right to the heart of the question about rigor, right? I'm certain that the student that went through that process had a very rigorous educational experience.
Right.
They learned a lot from the process of writing, getting feedback, talking through that feedback, revising. And so, you know, I think on a transcript, that might look like grade inflation, but I think at the end of the day, we're talking about a student there who probably had a very valuable educational experience and probably came out of that with some really useful tools that they could use in their future endeavors.
So this is kind of a case where it is by definition grade inflation, but it also is it is tied to much improved learning, or probably at least students coming out of that class having gained a lot.
Absolutely.
Okay. Professor Stacey.
Yeah, I mean, I respect professors and teachers who do that so much. That's so much time. And it's so much emotional support that you're giving to the students too. And I think that's the part of our job that people often don't talk about. You know, it can be very emotionally draining, but you also have to take care of yourself and you have to take care of the students. And if you are the kind of person who knows that you could handle students rewriting and coming back into your office and you can really empower them that way, I immense respect for that.
Okay. Larry?
Yeah, I think it's a terrific way of getting at that piece of work. It does raise the question of what's the capacity of the faculty. So if you know, Professor Cope is teaching, you know, I don't know, European intellectual history, probably not a lecture hall full of,
right.
And so you've got a reasonable number of students and you can maybe do something iterative like that, just like Thomas was saying about David O'Brien at the Harley School. He's able to work because he has a small number of students. He's able to, let's keep at this. Let's help you understand what it is to do a piece of work that's really good, that you can really be proud of, and let me show you how to get there. But if you have 50 students or however many you have, or, you know, 30 students in a classroom and you have five sections, you can't do that.
Yeah. Could I jump in on
that
too? I think, you know, also thinking about what we've been talking about here and the pressure that's really on faculty to deliver really a high quality educational experience, that does have to be squared against trends in higher education, which are moving towards using more contingent faculty, seeing faculty who are only teaching maybe one or two classes at multiple institutions in an area.
Yeah.
If we're not investing in teaching resources as higher education institutions, we're not creating the conditions where that kind of really intense hands-on learning can happen. And so I think that we have to think about those structural features as well.
Absolutely.
All right, back to your phone calls. This is Sharon in East Rochester. Go ahead, Sharon.
Hi, and hi to Leah. I'm Sharon Murphy, recently retired from Nazareth after 32 years.
Oh, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say, as all schools, and Nazareth, of course, have in their student booklet, the standard description of what the letter grade is, for example, A is excellent, B is very good, C is average, et cetera. And I got a comment once, I guess I had a reputation as a high grader, and at the end of the semester when you get, and we haven't mentioned this yet this afternoon, those student evaluations, which also have an impact on us in terms of grading, somebody wrote, "She thinks a C is average." Exclamation point. So I think that's also something. I think the students don't recognize that B is not average.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But Sharon, before I let you go, I think you brought up something that is kind of the elephant in the room for at least at the college level at times, which is student evaluations and the impact that those can have. Are those, can they be a problem?
Well, yes, because the students are responding subjectively, and we don't get a chance to answer or explain. So I don't know about the other professors here, but students tend to evaluate professors based on the grade.
Yes, yes. Students are human beings.
You know, we don't give grades. They earn grades. Duh.
Sharon, thank you. It's such an important point here. Now, this is where Leah Stacey, as a professor, may have a bit of an advantage here. Explain.
Yeah, so I have a little bit of a different track. So I'm not actively seeking tenure. I don't have a PhD. I'm a what we call professional practice professor. And so I do quite a bit of freelance working. That's actually part of my contract with Nazareth, and very important to Newhouse as well, because it keeps me active and up to date in the industry. And so I, when I am giving out grades, I never think about tenure. I never think about performance reviews. I do. I still have those, so I think about those in some terms. But I more, for me, it's more like my relationship with the student. I always think about the impact it's going to have on them. And there's part of me that says, like, oh, I feel, you know, maybe bad about giving this certain grade. But I also go back and I double and triple look at their work. And I say, you know, is this the level of work that they've given? So it's really hard because I also get very attached to the students. Mm. And I know some of them are listening right now because I'm getting messages from them. So hi, all of you. I'll see you very soon. But it's hard, but I do my best throughout the semester to really connect with them and say, like, hey, this part of the class is not going so well for you. And sometimes I am the one to reach out first.
But are evaluations a problem, you think? Can they
yeah,
tilt the scales a little?
Absolutely. We have a brand new evaluation system that we just kicked in at NAS, and I'm in Senate with other faculty members, and we had a very avid discussion about how most of the questions are focused on our specific performance. And that worried people. And I think that's fair. I think anybody who teaches and has this, you know, we're all like high performers and we care about our performance too. And I remember in the days of Rate My Professor, it was like the scariest thing ever at the end of the semester.
Are those gone already?
Well, not for everyone. But it doesn't seem like they use it that much anymore.
Okay,
I think now they probably just post about us on Snapchat or Instagram stories.
Especially if they're not happy.
Yeah, they're probably like putting some filter on us.
Okay. But at the very least, though, it does sound like there is a concern that on occasion professors might feel compelled, given the various ways students can review them.
Sure. Yeah.
And that psychologically,
I think there's some pressure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Professor Cope, what do you think?
I think a lot depends on institutional culture. You do have the model of tenure and promotion that's something akin to hazing, make it as hard and as unpleasant as possible. But I think, you know, if you think about a higher education institution as investing in its faculty, they want good people at that institution. Mm-hmm. They want those faculty to make a connection with the students. They want those faculty to support those students. In those kinds of cultures, I think you see other ways of evaluating teaching. At my college, in my department, multiple colleagues sitting in informally on classes, giving feedback, talking with you, this is what works, this is what doesn't work. Spontaneous creation of learning communities where faculty get together to talk about pedagogy and teaching strategies. And all of that, you know, in a perfect world, that ought to count as well in the evaluation of a faculty member's contribution to the institution. Student evaluations are one point of data, but there are all sorts of other ways that we can look at the effectiveness of a faculty member and alleviate some of that inherent stress that goes along with the tenure and promotion process.
Less of an issue at a school like Harley School?
Yeah, I would say much less of an issue. It is the case that we have feedback mechanisms for students, but it's not part of the evaluation process per se. It's really for mid-course corrections. Mm-hmm. Most teachers do them themselves.
All right, so before we lose the hour, you mentioned earlier there's a big difference in how kids, nursery all the way up through what we would call high school, learn,
right,
and how that may impact a discussion like this when we talk about how we grade, whether we're inflating, et cetera. You got a little time here. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I if I start making a speech, make a sign at me to stop. But, the quality of the high school transcript is super reductive. I can't think of a better word than that.
Yeah.
And it ends up forcing you to do certain things when you're giving a grade to a student. It makes you do certain things when you're building assessments for students. And ultimately, it forces schools into doing certain things when they are thinking about building program. If you're around toddlers, you know, they are all unbelievably good students. They're super joyfully engaged with everything they're doing. They want to touch everything. They want to learn about everything. They take everything in. They're curious about the world and joyfully plugged into it. What is it that we're doing that robs them of that at some point in their educational careers, right? It's a quality that at Harley, I'm proud to say, we try to continue to cultivate and protect, right? But because ultimately, I think that is the engine of the best kind of learning. And you end up producing a kid who has real inspiration about things, who's really passionately interested in various things in their lives. But ultimately, Harley, like other schools, we're producing transcripts. And when a kid is applying to SUNY Geneseo, and let's say they have a B-plus average or something like that, but there's a kid from, I don't know, Boonville up in the Adirondacks who's got the A-minus, we try to contextualize it. We try to make sure that it's clear, like, well, this is, you know, kind of what the program is like at Harley. But it just has this super reductive quality. So that's honestly the kind of long arc concern that I have about the conversation around grading. It forces us toward extrinsic stuff. It forces us toward kind of a multiple choice-ish way of thinking about what constitutes real learning, and away from, you know, what I think are more authentic questions about what teaching and learning should be.
Well, I think we've had a pretty good discussion, and I think this is a better way to have conversations like this, a little more texture, a little more nuance, not just putting entire generations of students into a small box, you know, with a few short adjectives.
And kids these days.
Kids these days. For Leah's students who are listening, you know, I think I was with you when it was my generation being stereotyped. We've all been there, so I appreciate all of the feedback, and I hope you like your students. I hope you're having a good time.
Me?
Yeah.
I love my students.
Well, you talked about them specifically on the air for those listening, so.
Yeah, no, I do what I love, and I'm very lucky to do that.
You all seem to be in that category, and it was a great conversation. Thank you for taking the time. Leah is a professor in English and Communication at Nazareth College and an adjunct in the Newhouse School of Communication at Syracuse University. Thank you, Leah. Thanks for being here. Thanks to Joe Cope, history professor and interim associate provost for student success at SUNY Geneseo.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Larry Fry, head of school at the Harley School. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
Short break, more connections coming up.